For our audience of blind and print impaired listeners, the North Carolina Reading Service presents The Indie Week. It's dated January 19th, 2022, and it's read by me, John Federson. And the musicians in today's effort performing our theme music are actually performing for their graduation ceremony from the Name on Request Music Academy. They're, as you may know, featured in all the advertisements all over the New York City subway system. They're doing wonderfully, don't you think? They finished that four-week intensive course on piano and violin and have just handed the music a few minutes before airtime. They're doing great. And we'll probably hear a little bit more of them at the end of the broadcast, so let's get going with the Indie Week. Now, I'm going to start very unusually, as something I don't read very often. This is Back Talk, which is letters to the editor. And this is one reader named Brandon Dorn about an article read a few weeks ago about the Pioneers in Durham, the homophobic Methodist church coffee shop co-working space that opened last week on Gear Street. In our paper last week, we published a letter, a pastor at Elizabeth Street United Methodist, which is located about half a mile away. And Brandon Dorn found Bowden's letter to be somewhat self-serving. As a Christian in Durham following news about Pioneers Church, I was interested to read a local pastor's perspective when I saw your piece in the Indie. I was hoping to find something that furthered the conversation in a helpful way, so was disappointed to instead read what is essentially amounted to a free advertisement for ESUMC. Instead of using the open letter as an opportunity for dialogue with Sherry and others from Pioneers, or even using it as a moment of public instruction on differing theologies of same-sex marriage, you instead used your piece to signal the virtues of ESUMC. In fact, you don't even mention Pioneers once beyond the first sentence, and implicitly make them out to be a judgmental, homophobic community as you extol ESUMC under the guise of telling your story. Ultimately, your piece just adds to the noise surrounding the topic. Instead of seeking dialogue or reconciliation, you publicly communicate a clear division as though winning denominational turf wars and increasing church attendance were more important than showing non-believers what it looks like to love people who hold different views. What disappointed me most about the piece, I think, was that it contributed to the perception that the church is mostly concerned with judgment. Your piece joins in on the culture wars and divisions at play in our nation rather than seeking a way to transcend them. I'm not defending Pioneers' position or the things Sherry or others have said. I have no connection to them, and I'm personally not sure where I stand on the topic of same-sex marriage. It's something I'm actively reading and thinking about. So I write this to you not to condemn your position, much less your congregation or the work that ESUMC is doing in the community, but rather in hopes of encountering better dialogue on a complex topic. And now on to the print edition of Indie Week and Tomasi McDonald's column from Durham, Coming Clean. Earlier this month on a chilly, late Saturday morning, Justin Poindexter shows up to clean a wide brown grass lot beside a Dollar Tree store in the Lowe's shopping center in southeast Durham. The tall, solidly built man wears baggy jeans with a lime green and orange vest over his black zipper coat and sweatshirt. A black toboggan perched atop his head, he wears sunglasses with mirror lenses that reflect the bright orange sun. A black neck gaiter covers his face. A patch reading Run Durham emblazons one of the vest's chest pockets. In the spirit of no one can do everything, but everyone can do something, for the past 3 years, Poindexter has used a long-handled grabber and large trash bags to haul away trash and debris, wine and liquor bottles, beer cans, cigarette butts, heroin needles, baby diapers, fast food bags, and used condoms from some of Durham's most violent communities. One of his cleaning stops is near the intersection of Guthrie and Holloway Streets in East Durham, which accounted for nearly a third of the city's record 49 homicide victims last year. Poindexter says, the main message is to restore the love back to the community. We count, and we can clean up on our own. It goes back to mental health and keeps property values appraisals up. There are studies that show a clean environment improves self-worth. If an area is clean, it's less likely to be a negative narrative about it. Poindexter, a 43-year-old native of Long Island, who moved to Durham in 2002 for a job teaching third graders with public schools, wants to send this message to the community and to a city ravaged by deadly gun violence. Owing largely to shootings in East Durham that took the lives of 17 people last year, including two 17-year-olds and two 15-year-olds, the predominantly working-class community is beset by a negative perception. Last month, shortly after a mass shooting in East Durham killed two teens and wounded four others, newly elected Mayor Elaine O'Neill issued a citywide challenge to halt what is essentially black fratricide. A clearly distraught O'Neill said during a hastily called press conference at the police department, "Law enforcement and the government can't tackle this issue alone. We need every member of the community to join us in this fight to save lives." Newly elected City Council member Leonardo Williams noted an uncomfortable truth about the city's gun violence epidemic. He said during his first City Council meeting last month, "The majority, or almost all of the people getting killed are black, and the majority, if not all of the people doing the killing are black. So, as a black man, I'm saying we have a problem that we as a community need to address. It's on all of us. You are your brother's keeper, and if you do nothing, you are part of the problem, so we need help." 2 years before O'Neill was even elected, Poindexter figured he could make a difference and alter the trajectory of deadly gunfire by simply picking up trash in several of the city's toughest neighborhoods. He says, "The new mayor is amazing. That touched me. There has to be people who want to stand up for what's right. We have to care." Before starting on the dormant field, Poindexter cleaned the asphalt lot next to the Dollar Tree. He says while working, "Lots of heroin needles here. People deserve to shop in a clean area. A lot of older people, mothers, shop here. I just feel like they are queens and don't need to see trash in the parking lot." Everyone from older residents to drug dealers thanks Poindexter and encourages him to keep cleaning. City officials know about him, too. Councilmember Williams says he first encountered Poindexter while campaigning for office, saying, "I never met him, but something I said while campaigning rang a bell with him, and he started sending me pictures of him cleaning the streets. So we have this anonymous relationship. I honor and support what he's doing. There's something in his heart that's leading him to want to do something right." After picking up every single piece of trash littering the asphalt lot, Poindexter turns his attention to that field whose sides slope upward to Fayetteville Street and MLK Boulevard, using the grabber to snatch up discarded cardboard boxes and heavy plastic. He explains, "I clean this whole thing. It could be my mother who comes here, my grandfather, my auntie." His transformation into a one-man cleaning crew echoes the words of the French Enlightenment writer Voltaire, who asserted that we must cultivate our own garden to ward off the three great evils, weariness, vice, and want. For Poindexter, it's about de-escalating violence and teaching young people to give one another a pass instead of reaching for the seemingly ubiquitous firearms in their waistbands. His quest to clean neighborhoods he cares about started 3 years ago. It was Saturday morning in his southeast Durham neighborhood, and he decided to take a walk. He walked outside and saw three empty vodka bottles on the side of the road. There was a dirty diaper to boot. and heroin needles. I thought, let me pick that up. He contracted the local chapter of NC Harm Reduction, which now supplies him with containers to properly store the discarded needles. He also asked for Narcan overdose kits. Lofton Wilson, a programs manager with the Durham chapter of NC Harm Reduction, told the Indy that in addition to supplying Poindexter with overdose kits, Wilson regularly picks up needles he collects from neighborhoods throughout East and Southeast Durham. The biohazardous needles are incinerated, says Wilson. Justin is such a friendly and warm presence, he says. People feel connected with him because he's very non-judgmental. Wilson says Poindexter works in a bunch of different communities. He's such a connector in the community, he adds. And he's always looking for ways to connect the community to groups. He's so passionate about cleaning up neighborhoods. One of the agencies Poindexter connected with is Keep Durham Beautiful. The nonprofit works in partnership with the city to organize volunteers that help with litter prevention and community greening. Tanya Doutlick, executive director of Keep Durham Beautiful, says for a little over a year, the nonprofit has supplied Poindexter with trash bags, that ubiquitous grabber, and gloves, saying, I remember him coming into the office and asking for supplies and sharing his vision for cleaning Durham. Doutlick says the nonprofit's hundreds of volunteers typically adopt one street. Not so with Poindexter. He adopted a number of streets, she explains. He's all over the place. Poindexter says something clicked inside him after picking up trash in his own neighborhood. He realized that collecting trash could be an opportunity to connect in the community with an authentic grassroots approach. Formerly, he'd made it his mission to teach third-grade English after reviewing studies that found children who had not attained reading proficiency by the fourth grade were less likely to succeed academically, graduate from high school on time, or do well in life and the workforce. He explains, studies have shown that a black boy who fails the third grade reading test has a greater chance of being incarcerated. Poindexter no longer teaches, but he's still an educator. He gives out free books to children who live in the neighborhoods where he cleans. He says, it's mostly at the places where I clean. If I see a black father at the park with his child, I'll give him a book. His zeal for cleaning up neighborhoods may be a metaphor for a quiet effort to come clean with a tragic episode in his own life. In 2017, following a 15-year teaching career in Durham, Poindexter resigned from the profession after he was charged with a felony hit-and-run accident that killed 72-year-old Philip Shaw. That happened just after 11 p.m. on Fayetteville Street near Hillside High School, not far from where Poindexter now cleans that Dollar Tree lot. It's not an easy subject for him to talk about. He says the accident happened on a Tuesday night. It was dark. He was not under the influence and was driving the speed limit when all of a sudden, quote, my front windshield was cracked and I heard a loud pow. I thought I thought someone was shooting. I didn't call the police. The next morning, the police raided my house. How can I not feel compassion and empathy for what happened? I was an elementary school teacher. For me, my whole life was turned upside down for doing something I do every day, driving down the street. Of course you're going to feel bad, but I'm not a victim. I want to change this narrative instead of being a victim. Shaw's family was not immediately available for comment. In 2019... Poindexter was convicted of felony hit and run, causing serious injury or death, and sentenced to 3 months in Durham County Jail. While in custody, Poindexter's passion for cleaning was born. He explains, in jail, the biggest job is cleaning. Since 2019, Poindexter has supported himself by working at restaurants, but his passion is cleaning. And while using a grabber, gloves, and trash bags in his quest to make Durham a safer place, he dreams of funding that will enable him to someday start his own business. I'm going to clean until somebody recognizes, he says. It's the American thing to do. Look out for one another. Help someone. Just help. I'm not an institution, but I want to stop the shootings and hire other people. I tell people, if you can put down the gun and pick up the grabber, you can't get a felony for this. And next, from Raleigh and Jasmine Gallup's column, Slipping Through the Cracks. Inevitable. That's the word many Hamel Drive occupants use to describe the slow and devastating transformation of their working-class neighborhood into a multi-million-dollar apartment complex. The gentrification of Raleigh seems inevitable to many living in formerly affordable houses, but that knowledge didn't soften the blow when residents and business owners near Dix Park were told to abandon their homes and offices within 30 days. Francisco Cerrone Sagastume was forced to move out after Christmas, says, "Right now, my partner and I were technically homeless. We're living in a hotel until we find housing." Cerrone Sagastume and his partner, Miguel Saldana, lived at their home overlooking the Raleigh skyline for 2 years before receiving that 30-day notice from new property owner SLI Capital in December, stating their lease would not be renewed. The Raleigh-based real estate investment firm bought 7.5 acres of open space plus existing homes and businesses at the corner of South Saunders and Hamel Drive, with plans to turn the property into a high-end apartment complex. The first phase of the project will result in two 20-story towers containing hundreds of apartments. The company also plans to build new commercial and office space. Development around Dix Park has spiked in the past year, especially as the Raleigh City Council moves forward with an ambitious plan to turn the oft-underused green space into the city's best public park. The first phase of the project is already underway, with landscape architects drawing up plans for a new plaza, complete with waterfall, playground, and picnic grove just off the street from that Hamel Drive development. Near the east corner of the park, off South Saunders Street, Kane Realty Corporation will soon start construction of a 10-story apartment complex with businesses on the ground floor, dubbed Park City South. A few blocks south, 145 acres on either side of South Saunders Street are reserved for more 12- and 20-story mixed-use developments. The rezonings, which were approved last year, would add more than 1,400 apartments to the city's housing supply, all along a major transportation corridor, with many within walking distance of the bus system and farmers market. But with so much housing demand, the units are unlikely to be affordable for those who previously lived along South Saunders Street. Cerrone Sagastume and Saldana weren't the only ones pushed out by the Raleigh development. Another four families who were subleasing homes from a nearby business owner were also displaced, says Cerrone Sagastume. "It's not okay that people are displaced and pushed out so easily," he says. "All these developers are just buying out all these homes in magnitude." The couple is now looking for another place to live in Raleigh, but like many, they're having trouble finding a home they can afford in such a competitive market. And he says, "The price of rent are nearly the same for a mortgage, so we might as well own. But the market is crazy. It's horrible. We've submitted multiple offers. No luck there." Businesses on Hamel Drive are having similar trouble. Although the developer has given most an extra month to move after facing backlash. Johanna Fernandez, owner of a building supply store, Sun HS Warehouse, says, "It's just been hard in this market to find something. I'm trying to look for a place around here, but I haven't found anything. There's not much available." Even if Fernandez does find a new location, moving will hurt her business, she says. She's been at her current location for 10 years and has built up a good customer base. "It's terrible. I'm going to lose a lot of my clients, and my business is going to suffer." And that's the best-case scenario. If Fernandez is not able to find another space for her business, she says ruefully, "I got to close." Likewise, Dennis Carter, owner of Anything with a Plug Recycling, is having trouble finding a new space. He says, I've had a broker helping me figure it out, but places he comes with are either too far away, too big, too small, and everything's as expensive as hell. The rent I have, I'll never find that again. In the worst-case scenario, Carter will have to move his recycling business to another property he rents as he keeps looking for a permanent home. Overall, he doesn't mind seeing new development, he says. Everybody enjoys that, he says, but you have to look at what the cost is to the people that are here. It makes prices go through the roof. When it comes to moving, more time is always better. Cerón, Sagastume, and Fernandez each said that having a few more months' notice would have made a critical difference in their lives. Under North Carolina law, however, landlords are only required to give a tenant 30 days' notice that they don't intend to renew an existing year-to-year lease agreement. City officials can ask development companies to give tenants more time, but state law often swings in favor of landlords. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin says, we've had this happen on Garner Road, where an apartment complex changed hands and people are given notice saying you have 30 days to move. We kind of stepped in and were able to work something out by talking to people and encouraging them to work with the tenants and give them more time. But things don't always work out so neatly. When the Hamel Drive property first changed hands, city officials talked with then-owner Atlas Stark about gradually relocating residents and business owners. Negotiations fell apart, however, when the property was then sold to SLI Capital and Mack Real Estate Group of New York. At that point, talks about giving more time to move ended. Baldwin says, going forward, when we look at rezoning neighborhoods, one of the things we need to put in is the conditions is, okay, what's your plan for displacement? We need to deal with that proactively so we don't have a situation where someone is surprised by a notice saying you have 30 days. That isn't fair to anybody. City Council Member Stormy Forte, whose district includes Hamel Drive, says she's had several conversations with people who want the city to be more aggressive when it comes to preserving affordable housing. People have suggested the city make its own bids for properties, such as those on Hamel Drive, where affordable homes already exist. But, Forte says, it's hard to do that when you're competing against investors in an open market under capitalism. Our pockets are not just deep enough to compete. Last year, Wake County approved a $10.5 million bond to protect such housing by buying apartment buildings and lots when they go on the open market. The city, on the other hand, is using $12 million from its affordable housing bond to buy both existing homes and land for future construction. We try to work, says Forte, with nonprofit partners and put as many resources into their coffers as we possibly can to help them build more affordable housing. The bottom line is that housing in the city is market-driven. Baldwin says, Raleigh's growing in leaps and bounds. We're a desirable place to live. What we're trying to achieve is some balance. With so many developers flocking to Raleigh, though, it seems, well, inevitable that some people will slip through the cracks. Cerón Sagastume says, the developers don't care. All they see is the potential to win some money, and I get it. But we don't have to lose empathy on the way. All right, from reprinted from North Carolina Health News, a column by Rose Hoban, Scrambling to Cope. Susan Paulson started having chest pain on Monday. The 60-year-old painter who lives in Chapel Hill waited 4 hours thinking it was indigestion, hoping it would go away. Besides, she didn't want to go near a hospital. She said, that seemed like a place I might catch it. referring to the Omicron variant of COVID that's been ripping through North Carolina's population. It's driven up the daily numbers of North Carolinians testing positive for the coronavirus. Since January 1st, the state has recorded at least 288,000 cases and had days of record-breaking case counts. Hospital leaders throughout the state have taken to the airwaves to plead with residents to come to emergency departments only when absolutely necessary. Paulson had heard those pleas. She said, "I didn't want to be going there for a silly reason and adding to the crowds." But her husband convinced her to call his dad, a retired cardiologist, who told her in no uncertain terms to get over to UNC Hospital. Good thing she did. She was having a heart attack. Paulson is the type of patient that hospital leaders across the state are worried will get lost in the shuffle as the state's healthcare institutions scramble to cope with a flood of patients infected by Omicron. ICUs are full of people admitted with respiratory failure, and regular treatment beds are also crowded with those showing up for other problems, but then also testing positive for the virus. Even as staff are calling in sick and unable to come to work because they are also testing positive. Christopher DiRienzo, Chief Medical Officer at Wake Med Health in Raleigh, says, "Omicron, no matter what you're doing right now, from following guidelines to testing it, it is saturating our community." Wake Med ICU is full of patients with COVID-19 respiratory disease, he said. "The overwhelming majority of ICU are unvaccinated," something echoed by healthcare leaders across the state. DiRienzo was one of these triangle-based healthcare leaders who held a joint call with reporters on January 6th to make a plea to the public to look somewhere other than emergency departments for COVID testing. Healthcare leaders across the state have held similar press conferences, and on Wednesday, letters from every North Carolina hospital issued a joint letter asking people to get vaccinated and boosted with another dose when eligible. Practice social distancing, wear masks, and wash their hands to help relieve the pressure on overwhelmed hospital. This week, the state's hospitals surpassed the record of COVID-positive patients set 12 months ago in the midst of last winter's surge, almost a year to the date. On Thursday, 4,275 people were hospitalized across the state with illnesses related to COVID, 741 of whom were in ICU beds. Shannon Carlson, a pulmonologist and head of intensive care at UNC Hospitals in Chapel Hill, said, "We're seeing as many ICU patients as we saw last winter." During last winter's surge, UNC had about 500 or so patients across its dozen inpatient facilities. By the beginning of this week, that number had topped 600 patients and kept growing. Further complicating the situation is that nearly 1,000 of the 30,000-plus staff are out. According to Alan Wolf, a UNC health spokesman, quote, "These are people who are either testing positive and not getting too sick because we have a vaccination requirement, or they're testing positive from exposure in the community. Those who test positive have to be out for at least 5 days, Wolf said. If an employee does not have symptoms after that, they can return to work. If they're still sick, they need to stay away. Quote, 1,000 people missing is a big crisis for us. Andre Fernandez, Regional Chief Medical Officer for Atrium Health and Wake Forest Baptist System, says, "Just like other hospitals in the area here, our team is exhausted. We've had to, as part of that COVID versus non-COVID care balance, we've had to stop all elective surgeries and are really having to prioritize and triage our time-sensitive cases." On Wednesday, according to Fernandez, there were a total of 236 hospitalized COVID patients with 53 on ventilators in the system's hospitals in Winston-Salem, Davie County, North Wilkesboro, and High Point. On Thursday, the triad region of the state, which includes Fernandez's system, had the most hospitalizations of any region, with close to 1,100 patients. Many of the Atrium Health Wake Forest Baptist staff are out sick, too. Fernandez says. That's really where the challenge is for us. We have more and more staff out. We don't have the ability to keep hospital beds open. A bright spot for Fernandez has been that because of the vaccine mandate for staff, many of those who tested positive for the disease are returning to work pretty quickly. That's not the case for all, though. Fernandez said, this is not a cold. They can have fever, bad cough. They can have significant fatigue that doesn't allow them to care for families and their patients. And so that's why we need to keep them out until they're well. Another light amid the darkness, she said, is that the community is starting to heed the hospital's calls to take precautions. Several large events planned in Forsyth County over the past week were canceled or postponed, Fernandez said, showing a commitment to try not to add to the virus spread. She said, people are starting to get the fact that this is worse than the flu, worse than a cold, and can actually have significant implications on chronic conditions and can worsen chronic conditions and can have effects that last well beyond those 5 days. David Wohl from UNC Health said COVID is so widespread in the community right now, it's not uncommon to be treating someone who had a traumatic injury and after swabbing their nose learned the patient is also COVID positive, saying, there are people who come in not for COVID who get progressively more ill, from mildly symptomatic to actually having symptoms while in the hospital. What adds to the workload, he said, is that often they need to treat the COVID along with the thing that brought them to the hospital in the first place. But a large majority of patients in UNC's intensive care units who are COVID positive are there because the virus has sickened them, not because they tested positive incidentally while seeking other care. At Wake Med, DiBienzo said it was likely that some incidental COVID patients are arriving with issues that were exacerbated by their COVID diagnosis. For example, he said, citing a Swedish study, someone may have COVID and their risk of heart attack goes up 3 times during the first week of illness. After that diagnosis, it gradually falls, but it stays up for stroke and for COPD exacerbations, for asthma, you name it. There's a whole range of other things. That makes it a folly to try to distinguish whether people are in the hospital with COVID or because of COVID, he added. And he said, if someone has diabetes and they go into diabetic ketoacidosis, you know, a very serious sequela of diabetes, we know that viruses can trigger that. Is that COVID-related? Who makes that call? For those patients who arrive with other problems and are then diagnosed with COVID, the intensity of care increases. Fernandez said, we wouldn't want to mix those populations if at all possible. We bring them to one of our COVID units. We manage the disease process. Our nurses do have to spend a lot more time gowning up, putting on their goggles, putting on their N95s to go in those rooms. The care that's delivered is just more arduous. All of the hospital leaders estimated that fewer than 20% of patients are incidental COVID cases. Even at that percentage, with soaring hospitalizations, the number of people in beds because of a COVID diagnosis is likely to go up more before trending downward, they added. DiRienzo said, test positivity is the first thing to crest. Then several days later, a week later, maybe 7 to 10 days, hospitalizations begin to crest, and then ICU comes after that, and then, unfortunately, deaths follow that. If past is prologue, then I would certainly hope we begin seeing a crest in the case wave over the course of this week. And I'm sort of looking toward the end of next week as a point where I'm hoping to begin seeing a stabilization in hospitalization numbers. In the meantime, DiBienzo said that he hopes people experiencing chest pains, like Paulson, do continue to make their way to area hospitals to get the emergency care they need. He was disturbed to hear about her hesitation. Fortunately, she was treated with medicines and released after 1 day. DiVincenzo said. I'm sure there are folks out there right now who need care for something and are scared and are going to delay. We're all working tremendously hard to maintain access to the full spectrum of care. Well, our cover story in this week's Indie Week is titled Restoring the Faith, and it's about convicts' claims of innocence. It's written by Keith Barber. The American poet and philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson said in his 1841 essay, Compensation, justice is not postponed. But the stack of handwritten letters on Jamie Lau's desk says otherwise. Lau, a professor at Duke University School of Law, attributes the influx of mail to national publicity surrounding the exoneration of Ronnie Long more than a year ago. It's had a big impact, says Lau. The mail all begins, after reading about Mr. Long's case in prison news, I'm writing to you about my case. Screening handwritten letters from North Carolina inmates is the first stage of an arduous process that sometimes takes decades. It begins with a Duke Law student assessing the credibility of an inmate's claim of innocence, then sending out a questionnaire to the letter's author to gather more information about their case. After that completed questionnaire comes back, Duke Law students participating in the Innocence Project, a national network often based in law schools, consult with their cohorts before referring cases to the school's wrongful convictions clinic. Attorneys Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld founded the Innocence Project in 1992 at Cardozo School of Law in New York City. Over the past three decades, the flagship Innocence Project has achieved 375 DNA exonerations. Since 1989, there have been close to 3,000 exonerations of innocent individuals nationally, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. Innocence projects, not directly affiliated with the nonprofit Schecht and Neufeld founded, have achieved the majority of those exonerations. According to the American Association of Law Libraries website, there are 68 innocence organizations in the United States. In North Carolina, the NC Center on Actual Innocence, Duke's Wrongful Convictions Clinic, and Wake Forest University's Innocence and Justice Clinic are part of the Innocence Network. But students in clinics at several other North Carolina law schools are also learning invaluable lessons about ensuring justice for those entangled in the criminal justice system, whether or not they're working on cases directly. James E. Coleman, Jr., has served as director of the Wrongful Convictions Clinic at Duke since its inception in 2007. Back then, Coleman and now retired Duke Law professor Teresa Newman advised students participating in the Innocence Project. In 2001, Coleman and Newman were instrumental in creating the NC Center on Actual Innocence. That's a collaborative effort between Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill. The purpose of the NC Center was to prevent duplicate efforts by law school-based innocence projects and to serve as a central hub for all claims of innocence made by incarcerated individuals in North Carolina's prison system. Duke Law relied on the NC Center for 20 years to perform the initial screening of letters from inmates until this past spring. Now, Duke Law students screen all the letters with claims of innocence. The NC Center on Actual Innocence has evolved over the past two decades from being a clearinghouse for claims of innocence to performing reinvestigations and offering legal representation to inmates. Coleman says, it actually goes back to what we intended in the beginning, in that the NC Center would be involved with the students in screening cases and doing a preliminary review. Rich Rosen, a retired UNC law professor, and Pete Weitzel, a former UNC journalism professor, worked with Coleman and Newman to establish the center. Rosen characterizes its evolution as inevitable and necessary, given the prevalence of wrongful convictions. He argues there's value in both the law schools and the center's approaches to reinvestigating cold cases and filing legal appeals on behalf of clients. Coleman lauds the center's executive director, Christine Muma, for the results she and her staff of attorneys have achieved in securing exonerations. Continuing, but as a result of her basically doing investigations and representations, we don't have someone who's doing the screening and working with our students on that. Rosen says that now there are two different models of innocence work in North Carolina. He says, the law school model is really good. I also think the center model is really good. Frankly, there's enough need out there for all the different ones to have an impact. Six law schools in North Carolina have innocence projects. Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, NC Central, Campbell University, Elon University, and Wake Forest. However, only Duke and Wake Forest support law school clinics that directly address wrongful convictions and so are officially part of the National Innocence Network. For Lau and Coleman, the immersive experience helps achieve Duke's overarching vision of shaping the next generation of lawyers. Coleman says, I hope that we are training the lawyers who will replace us eventually. I hope that the clinic will continue as long as there are people who are wrongfully convicted in prisons in North Carolina. The work and the skills we develop will be important in the practice of law into the foreseeable future. There may be no better example of the law school model as a means to overturn a wrongful conviction than the case of Dante Sharp. In 1995, a Pitt County jury convicted Sharp of the murder of George Radcliffe in an incident police described as a drug deal gone bad. In 2010, Caitlin Swain was a second-year law student at Duke, working in a leadership position at Wrongful Convictions Clinic. Sharp's case captured her attention as she began reading about the circumstances surrounding the police investigation and subsequent prosecution. Joined by law school colleague Nikita Coutinho, Swain first met with Sharp at Harnett Correctional Institution in Lillington that spring. The experience confirmed Swain's belief that Sharp had been railroaded by the criminal justice system. And Swain recalls, what Sharp told me and Coutinho at that time was, I don't want you all to be sad or disappointed if you can't get justice, because there's so many people who have come before you, and I know they've all tried their best. But I've given up on there being justice in this justice system. Sharp had good reason to feel discouraged. After he won his 2009 appeal, the North Carolina Attorney General's office fought a lower court decision, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit ultimately ruled in favor of the state. It appeared all was lost, but a visit from the two Duke Law students marked a turning point in Sharp's quest for justice. He says, I was at a low point in my life at that time, but they came, and that was like an answer to my prayers. Swain and Coutinho began their reinvestigation in earnest after that initial face-to-face meeting with Sharp. Swain recalls, there was a lot of fear and wariness among many people in Greenville who had tried to tell the truth about this case in the past, and one of the things that was important to Coutinho and I was to try to start fresh in this investigation. Persistence ultimately paid off as Swain and Coutinho went door to door in Sharp's old neighborhood to try to persuade residents with information about the case to come forward. The breakthrough moment occurred when Charlene Johnson, the state's primary eyewitness at Sharp's trial, agreed to speak with them. Johnson was 13 years old when she implicated Sharp in Radcliffe's murder, but within a few months of Sharp's conviction, Johnson recanted her testimony. No forensic evidence ever linked Sharp to the crime scene. Swain recalls joining Newman, the clinic's then coordinator, and Sharp's attorney as of 2010 to visit Sharp in prison regularly over the course of 9 years as his appeals wound through the system. Coleman says the fact Swain continued to join Newman, who advised Duke Law students in the clinic until her retirement in 2021 on those visits, reflects the enduring strength of the program. Coleman says all of our cases are litigated by the clinic as a team. Although each case has a lead counsel, Newman, Lau, and I play active roles in all the exonerations. We don't have any case in which that has not been true. Throughout Sharp's appeals, Swain says she never lost hope, and ultimately her hope was rewarded. On August 22nd of 2019, a Superior Court judge in Pitt County granted Sharp's motion for appropriate relief, vacating his 1995 conviction. In November, Governor Roy Cooper granted Sharp an official pardon of innocence, meaning Sharp is entitled to seek compensation from the state for wrongful incarceration. Over the course of 11 years, Swain and Sharp formed a strong bond, which Swain credits as her inspiration for launching Forward Justice, a nonprofit that works with social justice organizations, coalitions, and networks to pursue criminal justice reform. She hired Sharp as the nonprofit's first returning in service and excellence leadership fellow. Swain says, I now get to go work with my first client, which is phenomenal, incredible outcome. Sharp's case is one of 10 exonerations the Wrongful Convictions Clinic has achieved over its 14-year history. The North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence has achieved 8 exonerations in its 20-year history. And MUMA says the NC Center on Actual Innocence maintains a close working relationship with the law schools at UNC, Chapel Hill, Central, Campbell, and Elon, but students don't take active roles in reinvestigating criminal cases, crafting legal briefs on behalf of the center's clients, or doing active casework. MUMA says, I often have to make the decision not to take a case forward, despite the fact I feel strongly the inmate has a credible claim and will likely die in prison. I also make a decision to take cases forward where there is no clear avenue for new evidence, but there may be ineffective assistance of counsel that led to the wrongful conviction. Those are not decisions law students are equipped to make. Mark Rabel, director of the Innocence and Justice Clinic at Wake Forest School of Law, takes a different approach with his law students. Rabel, who is acclaimed for securing the freedom of Daryl Hunt in 2004, has officially led the clinic as its full-time director since 2013. Wake Forest law students review and investigate North Carolina inmates' claims of innocence and pursue legal avenues for exoneration and release. Students work closely with Rabel and attorney Emily Thornton to screen, evaluate, and litigate innocence cases. The Innocence and Justice Clinic has screened cases for many years rather than relying on the NC Center on Actual Innocence, says Rabel. Quote, we currently have about 20 cases with pending motions or litigations. We have litigated cases at every level, from NC Superior Courts to Appellate Courts, Federal Appeal District Court, and on to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Student participation in the appeals process on behalf of the client's clinics, student participation in the appeals process on behalf of the clinic's clients is a hallmark of the Wake Forest program. In 2019, Raquel McGregor, a Wake law student, represented John Robert Hayes, a Winston-Salem man convicted of 2 counts of second-degree murder in 1994 before the Fourth Circuit Court in Richmond, Virginia. The appeal was denied, but Rabel and Thornton recently filed a motion to order new forensic and DNA testing in Hayes' case. Rabel says demand from North Carolina inmates with legitimate claims of innocence far outstrips the supply of law students participating in clinics at Wake Forest and Duke, so at times it feels like they're only scratching the surface. At Wake Forest, Rabel says there's currently a 2-year wait list for case screenings. About 500 cases are in various stages of review or litigation, and the clinic has had to reject well over 2,000 cases. But the effort is clearly worth it. Rabel says, in the last year, we have been successful in winning release for two of our innocent clients through parole. One person had been incarcerated for 42 years, and the other for 29 years. Marissa Bluestein helped achieve 17 exonerations during her 10 years as director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project. Bluestein, now assistant director of the Quattron Center for the Fair Administration of Justice at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, cited a 2018 study authored by her Penn colleague, criminologist Charles Leffler, as even more evidence of the urgent need for criminal justice reform. The study estimated that 6% of incarcerated individuals in Pennsylvania state prisons are innocent. Extrapolating based on the current U.S. prison population, Leffler's findings indicate that roughly 108,000 innocent people are currently sitting behind bars. Altering public perception about the issue of wrongful convictions is the key to bringing forth change, says Bluestein. Quote, if overnight somehow we were able to identify all 4,500 people in Pennsylvania who were wrongly convicted or innocent, and they all walked out of prison on the same day, there would be an outcry. Just outcry and outrage of, we got to fix this, she said. Law school clinics are not the only effective approach to the issue of wrongful convictions, but educating future lawyers on the flaws inherent in the system is vital, adds Bluestein. It is incumbent upon us as professors and practitioners to be able to ensure that students who are in law school now understand these issues of wrongful convictions and how we've gotten them and how we kind of work our way around them. Shoshana Silverstein screened the 2006 HBO documentary The Trials of Daryl Hunt, which chronicles Hunt's 19-year fight for justice during law school orientation in 2017. Silverstein learned of Hunt's case when he died by suicide in March 2016. And he recalls, the video ended, we all looked around, and we were all a little bit in shock at how wrong the system can go. After participating in the Duke Law Innocence Project in her first year of law school, Silverstein joined the Wrongful Convictions Clinic in 2018. That's when she was introduced to Ronnie Long's case. On October 1st, 1976, Long, a black man, was convicted of sexual assault, burglary, and unlawful entry by an all-white jury in Cabarrus County. He was sentenced to life in prison but steadfastly maintained his innocence. Duke Law's Wrongful Convictions Clinic filed Long's third petition for a writ of habeas corpus. That's a legal recourse through which an inmate can report an unlawful imprisonment before a court. That third petition writ in 2016, which was ultimately denied by a federal magistrate. In January 2020, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals denied Long's appeal of the magistrate's decision by a 2-1 vote. Silverstein recalls receiving the news. I was standing in line at the grocery store and I got the email. I began reading about what we were going to do. Lau and his students would pursue a very narrow legal avenue, en banc review, in which a petitioner requests a rehearing before the full panel of judges. Cutting her winter break short, Silverstein flew back to North Carolina the next day. Sitting in airports, Silverstein strategized on the phone with law school colleagues about how they would craft a legal appeal in roughly 2 weeks. On May 7, 2020, Lau argued Long's case before the Fourth Circuit. Silverstein recalls feeling a wave of emotions as she listened in her kitchen in Vermont to Lau's live presentation on the court's website. She says, it was a combination of nerves and confidence. I just remember feeling in that moment that bit of hope taking over the nerves and saying, the judges understand it. We have a chance here. We have a real chance to right a horrible wrong that has just continued on for decades. On August 24, 2020, the court reversed the dismissal of Long's habeas petition by a vote of 9-6. 3 days later, Long was a free man. And once again, Silverstein was overcome with emotion. She recalls, "I was just standing in the kitchen shaking. It really seemed or felt in times impossible. So to have it succeed, again, especially in that time when the world seemed like everything was going wrong, to have this go right was the best thing that could possibly happen to me or to our team." Today, Silverstein works as an assistant district attorney for the city of Philadelphia. She likens her role to a defense team's adversary in the Long case, the NC Attorney General's office. She says, "I am now very much part of the system. I decided to take up the role of the attorney who was opposite us in the Long case to try to create the charge that I would hope they create. Excuse me. Or create the change I would hope they create." I ask the readers, listeners, pardon. I'm stumbling over these words. Anyway, to continue. "Mumma, Rabel, and Coleman may disagree on the best model for achieving exonerations of wrongful incarcerated individuals, but they are in accord in one respect. They point to the NC Attorney General's office as the greatest impediment to real reform. Law speculates state law enforcement officials irrationally fear that admitting the criminal justice system is deeply flawed and miscarriages of justice do occur will somehow make it harder for them to obtain convictions in the future. Lau argues there's a flip side to that coin. Specifically, if state attorneys general and local DAs cooperated with law school clinics and other innocence organizations to get to the truth in actual innocence cases, it would inspire greater confidence in the system." And Lau addressed the issue directly during oral arguments in that Long case before the Fourth Circuit, citing overwhelming evidence of police and prosecutorial misconduct in the original investigation. Lau called upon NC Attorney General Josh Stein's office to simply acknowledge the facts of the case. And he told the 15-judge panel, "If the state was interested in justice, this is a problem with the culture of the Attorney General's office in North Carolina. If it was interested in justice, it would have begun an investigation into the conduct of those police officers to determine what went wrong here." "Ultimately, leadership matters when it comes to criminal justice reform," says Lau. Quote, "We've long maintained that while the Attorney General's office has a duty to represent the state in these cases, its duty to represent the case is not limited to fighting to defend the conviction against all evidence that's presented to it." Stein's press secretary, Nazneed Akman, pushed back on Lau's contention that the Department of Justice isn't interested in seeking the truth in cases of documented misconduct by police and prosecutors, but rather upholds convictions at all costs.